From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll talk with author Douglas Wissing about his new book about Indiana.
Then I'll find out about all the new things the Vonnegut Library has planned.
And I'll get a preview of Bob Direck's production of Billy Elliot. And we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. For years, Douglas Wissing has been writing essays about what makes Hoosiers special. And now his distinctive pieces have been collected in Writing, Uncovering the Unexpected Hoosier State. Sharon Gamble invited Douglas to our studios to hear about how he got interested in topics as wide-ranging as Bedford limestone, modernist architecture, and a world-renowned cheese artisan.
I have to ask, are you from Indiana?
I'm about as Hoosier as you get. My family were French fur traders who came to Vincennes in the 18th century, and we have pretty much stayed there since. On my father's side, they were Alsatians who came in the 1850s and started what else? A brewery.
And this book, among other things, I'm going to make a bad pun, taps into the history of beer in our state. But I'd like you to start with, you have a lovely lyrical essay called The Song of Indiana, and I'd like to ask you to read just the first two or three paragraphs of that for us.
Sure. What is the Song of Indiana? Perhaps it's a Cole Porter or a Hoagy Carmichael tune, a song by John Mellencamp or Moonlight on the Wabash. Maybe it's a Gregorian chant from the St. Myron monks, or a Tibetan chant from Bloomington, or a bean blossom bluegrass lament, or a Shipshawana Amish hymn. Or maybe it's the jingle of the reins as the draft horses pull through the fields, or the murmur of a brook, or the shush of Lake Michigan waves, the pushy cry of a red-winged blackbird, the heartrend of a whippoorwill, or the chuff of a train. The silence of a Quaker service, or the scream of an Indy race car. Or maybe it's all those things. I have driven from one end of this great state to the other, zigzagging across the dimples and folds and flatlands of Indiana, winding down countless country lanes. And I can testify that there is a lot of Indiana to experience. The glint of the dawn on the Ohio River, the powder sugar hills of the dunes, canal boats, vintage cars, and old-time trains, fireflies dotting the summer field into a pointless canvas, and forests ablaze with autumn color stretching to the horizon, the smell of new hay, old wine, and campfires flickering on a cool evening. Ah, Indiana, here's to your rivers and roads and endless prairies, to your expansive forests and deep lakes, to your layers of history and the energy of your many cultures, and especially to your people, who twang out their greetings and take the time to tell you how to get there.
One of the things I like about this collection of essays is that, as well as describing the interior workings of Indiana, which are captured so beautifully in your little survey there that you just read to us, you draw lots of diagrams for us as to how Indiana is connected to neighboring states, the rest of the country, the rest of the world, the rest of the universe. And these pieces were not written to be collected into a book. These were written at various times, right?
That's right. This is a selection of hundreds of articles that I have written about Indiana that have come out everywhere from the New York Times and Los Angeles Times to our regional publications, The Star and the Indianapolis Monthly and the Indiana Historical Society's Traces magazine. And to a certain extent, there's some order to them, but it's more of a pointillist kind of approach. Here's a bunch of ways of thinking about Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
But one theme that I realize does run through my work is our connections to the larger world. And when I was a kid, my beloved grandfather, Clarence Stout Sr., he would take me to the Wabash. And as I mentioned, I'm a Creole, an Indiana Creole. And he would point upstream to Quebec, and he would say, well, our people paddled down from there. And he would point downstream and talk about when he was a kid, the Wild Boys would jump on boats and go to New Orleans to see what a real Creole city looked like. And I think it's stuck in my mind while we're in Indiana, and as a boy I was in Vincennes, kind of an out-of-the-way place, but it placed in my mind we were connected. And so a lot of my work has to do with those unexpected connections. When Osama bin Laden came to Indianapolis, and when jihadism was part of our culture here in Indiana, when you know, the Dalai Lama's older brother being in Bloomington and there being a wholly counterintuitive Tibetan cultural center down there. Being with Hoosier farmer soldiers in the wildest province in Afghanistan and watching these connections between Hoosier farmers and Afghan farmers that then when I would repeatedly go back to that same province, they would ask, how are the Hoosiers doing? And wanting to know about their friends that they had made, the Afghan farmers. So I see us having a lot of connections to the world.
You're trained as a historian as well as a writer.
That's right.
How did you decide history had a hold on you, and why journalism, why writing?
That's a great question. I think being trained as a historian gave me a certain rigor that is essential as a journalist, in my opinion. And I like to tell stories. I like to listen to people's stories. Being a journalist is the best thing in the world because you get to ask people their 10 best stories that their family, you know, everybody's eyes roll back. Oh, my God, granddad's telling that story again. But it's a great story. We all have 12 great stories. And I get to come along and ask people about the things that they're most passionate about. And that's a great gift.
And a perfect description of getting to host an interview show, too. Now, you've done a lot of war coverage, especially in the last few years. Has that made you think differently about your Indiana colleagues, your peers, your roots in Indiana?
When people talk about other places that they aren't familiar with, sometimes I think it's just an abstraction because what I've found is that the world is comprised of mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers. And if I go to that level and stay there, one, the world opens up a lot. And two, it just helps me understand things. I find far more commonalities than not. People are different in very many ways, and I search to understand how those places are unique. I look for people who have the eye of a poet. They're in a culture, but they are a little akimbo to it. They can describe it to me. So I look for the poetry of a place. But it comes back to the things that we all know here. It's not any different.
How do you, your ear is clearly attuned to those people who are a little akimbo to the whatever society they're in. Do you have some tried and true ways of recognizing those people?
I don't have the top 10 questions. You run across them and you don't know, and there are, you just get a sense of, one of the things I love about Tibet is they think the gods are among us. It could be that old lady over there. It could be that man there. It could be that child there. And so you have to look at everybody like they have something divine to tell you. And so it means you have to pay attention.
You have to be aware. There's never just walking through a crowd and dismissing them all as, oh, that's just a crowd of people at a farmer's market in Bloomington.
Yeah, Walt Whitman had a thing about walking the streets of Manhattan saying, that could be me. That could be me. That could be me.
Mm.
And that seems like a good way to be.
I have to ask you, you've collected your various essays, which span how many years?
Probably about 20 years of essays.
That's about a couple of decades. Into some fabulous subsets: Saints and Sinners, Complicated Places, Culinary Delights, Artists and Their Craft, and The Present Past. How did you decide on your themes when you were looking at? Because clearly in a couple of decades, you've written lots more than could possibly be collected in this book. But what was your organizing principle? How did that start?
I guess I figured out a long time ago, I write about what I'm curious about.
Hmm.
And so as I went through things, I like art, I like food, I like places that are unique in different ways. I'm often drawn to unusual characters, from Bobby Knight in Bloomington to Ezra Pound at Wabash College, General Lewis B. Hershey, the father of the draft, who was a Hoosier boy from up by Angola, that have a particular way of looking at the world, mm-hmm. sometimes not most commonly ways that I wouldn't think about or even particularly like, but it's a great exercise to try to understand them.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of your subjects give you the chance to go someplace and dig into archives. I had no idea of our complicated history with alcohol in our state until I read your unpacking of that.
You're speaking about the prohibition.
Yeah.
That was us. And you know, there are parts of Indiana history that get a little suppressed or shadowy. And the Ku Klux Klan's role in prohibition and the temperance movement is something that is uncomfortable for us in a state where the Klan essentially ruled the state for a period, and that gets reused in different ways, but that was certainly part of that history, prohibition.
Were there pieces that you wanted to pull into this collection that there just wasn't room for?
Sure.
Is there another collection in the works?
One never knows. One
is
never
your publisher
knows.
Listening? And you've been doing, you have, as we mentioned a little bit earlier, you have been doing a lot of war coverage. Do you ever get scared?
One would be insane if one didn't get scared.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way it is. So when we talk about the post 9/11 wars, the way we do wars in the 21st century. And of course, it's all volunteer army now.
Right.
Only 1% of our population are part of the military. And I can testify that the price that we're extracting from those men and women and their families, 5 rotations. I have met people who have been through 13 rotations, special operations troops. The psychic price, the psychological price, the physical price of that is just horrifying. We have never, ever asked military to serve these numbers of rotations in war zones. And it's a new kinds of wars, but we're exacting a great price, and Americans really need to understand that. And we need to. I have another book coming out on the Afghanistan War. My first book was entitled "Funding the Enemy: How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban," about our completely flawed and failed counterinsurgency in Afghanistan that has essentially wasted $1 trillion of American taxpayers' money. This book, I have a book coming out in August entitled Hopeless But Optimistic, journeying through America's endless war in Afghanistan. There are many people in the military-industrial complex, in political positions, who are interested in continuing these wars that are work out very well for the development corporations, for the military corporations. If we were accomplishing our military and strategic goals, that might be fine, but we're essentially asking for great sacrifice and we're not accomplishing our goals. So it's important for people to understand that.
Sharon Gamble with Douglas Wissing. His new book, In Writing, as in Indiana, IN Writing, Uncovering the Unexpected Hoosier State, is published by IU Press and available at bookstores and online. Learn more about the author and historian at douglaswissing.com. Again, douglaswissing.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. The Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library has some big plans, including a new building on Mass Ave. Travis DiNicola spoke with the library's chief operating officer, Matthew Altizer, about everything Vonnegut.
Matthew, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Man, there is just so much, it seems, going on with the Vonnegut Library. I mean, you guys are in the paper left and right, and new building and campaign and Year of Vonnegut, and it's awesome. There's a lot to figure out. So let's sort through it. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. Yeah, it's certainly keeping us on our toes, but we're really pleased with everything. First off is the new building. We're looking at moving to a new permanent location right there on Mass Ave, which is kind of the hub of everything downtown these days.
And we're really excited. This is a big deal.
So
the Vonnegut Library has been in its current location, the Katz & Korn law firm building, which is sort of right off the canal.
Correct.
And you guys have been there for, what, 5 years?
5 years, yeah. Okay. We just celebrated our fifth anniversary, and, we can't thank Katz & Korn enough. Yeah. They took a chance on a small organization 5 years ago and helped us and watched us grow through everything. And now, we're looking to see if we can take that next big step and, really kind of quadruple our size for more exhibitions, more programming, and more room for staff as well, our growing staff.
Yeah. So. I mean, the current space is nice, but it's a little tight. I mean, there's a good gallery space. There's a sort of a small exhibition space, a little small gift shop, but it's, it doesn't give you a whole lot of options.
That's correct. Yeah. It's about 1,100 square feet where we are right now in the Katz & Korn building. And the new building, which is 646 Mass Ave, is 5,400 square feet. It's a beautiful building. It fits with what we're trying to do. The Vonnegut family, who's come in to see the building, have all loved it. We're very happy that Scott Vonnegut, who is Kurt's nephew, who is also an architect, is actually doing the design of the inside of the building for us. So it'll still have that Vonnegut architecture connection that is so important to Indianapolis history. The gift shop will expand. We're working on a new Slaughterhouse 5 exhibition, which will be housed permanently in that location when we open it up. So
the space that you guys are looking at, Dean Johnson had its design from upstairs over the years. Different things have been downstairs. Christopher West had his gallery there for a while. Chris Bowman had a pop-up shop. It's a great location, as you said, right on Mass Ave, Cultural Trail, right across from Liberty Street and Teeny and sort of in that part of the neighborhood of Mass Ave, which is right in the middle of everything. I mean, that alone, I mean, just much higher visibility.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's really a game changer for us. The foot traffic is going to expand, and it just makes sense. You know, we're so close to the Athenaeum, or we will be so close to the Athenaeum,
which
is
away.
Designed by Kurt's father or grandfather. And then we're, a couple blocks away from the beautiful Vonnegut mural there at the end of Mass Ave. It just makes sense.
It totally makes sense. Yeah. It's really exciting. And you guys will be able to do so much more. This is a huge undertaking, though, right? I mean, you guys have to raise a lot of money in a short period of time to be able to make this happen.
That is true. Yeah. So we, you know, the board of
not
directors
to put you on the spot. There,
oh,
but, you know.
No, no, it's completely true. Our board of directors, who is very supportive of the move, has asked us to raise $750,000, mm-hmm. which will be a large chunk of money to make this happen. By July 15th, we have to raise that money. So we have, you know, a capital...
July 15th of this year.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, okay.
So a few weeks from now. We have a nice chunk of money already saved back for it. Mm-hmm. We just opened up a Kickstarter campaign that is going well. It's been up for, not too long, and already the money is coming in. And the Kickstarter campaign is nice because it's bringing in a lot of those Vonnegut fans from around the world who want to support this and who know that they want to come to Indianapolis to get that Vonnegut experience.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, Vonnegut obviously is extremely popular around the world, not just here in Indianapolis. You mentioned your board of directors. I think one thing that's sort of unique to your organization is that a lot of your board members are not just Indianapolis-based. I mean, you have board members from all around the country and some pretty well-known people, too.
That is correct. Yeah, we have a great board. We have some board members from Kentucky, New York. The list kind of goes on. In addition to that, we have a wonderful advisory board that includes some of Vonnegut's children. Mark Vonnegut, who is Kurt's son, mm-hmm. is a voting member on our board. His two daughters, Nanny and Edie, are both on the advisory board. And then an honorary board that includes, you know, some really great entertainers and authors of great importance.
Give me a couple names.
Tim O'Brien, who mm-hmm. I'll mention. We actually have Tim O'Brien coming in to do a talk with WFYI
mm-hmm.
on July 15th. So we're really excited about that. The two Vonneguts, Dave Eggers, I believe, is on mm-hmm. our honorary board, if I remember correctly. Bob Whitey has done a lot of work with us as well. So
that's great.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that certainly helps. I mean, having
that
national and even international appeal,
mm-hmm.
Which makes it a little bit more feasible than, let's say, if you were, just sort of looking at Indianapolis as your pool.
That is correct. Yeah. Yeah. It's, we do have a lot of support from Indianapolis,
mm-hmm.
but it is an organization that can reach beyond Indianapolis for assistance when needed. And everybody has been extremely supportive of that when we do reach out there.
Are you getting support from the city, from tourism, Visit Indy, downtown, I mean, that sort of thing?
Yeah, we are. Everyone is very supportive. Mayor Joe Hogsett is supportive of the move. Visit Indy is very supportive of the move. I think everyone sees it as a plus, not only for our organization, but for the city itself to really push the native son of Indianapolis a little stronger to help tourism and everything. So... yeah.
So once this happens, I mean, you know, you mentioned obviously just having more space, being able to have more staff and room for them and bigger gift shop and stuff. But what type of exhibits or other things do you imagine utilizing that space?
Well, the nice thing is we'll be able to do a little more educational outreach.
Mm-hmm.
We are currently working on a partnership with Indy 11 to go into IPS middle schools and help the middle school students find their voice and use the written word to, you know, work through some struggles. This kind of came about with a conversation that Julia had. Julia is our CEO and founder.
Mm-hmm. Julia Whitehead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Julia Whitehead. She had a conversation about Indiana being ranked, I believe, second in the nation for suicidal thoughts, I believe it is,
mm-hmm.
in middle schools. And that really struck, you know, a tone with her.
Yeah.
And, Kurt Vonnegut, her mother was, his mother was potentially had committed suicide mm-hmm. or had overdosed. And Kurt Vonnegut himself had committed suicide or tried to commit suicide in the 80s. And
okay.
so it's something that's near and dear to mm-hmm. the Vonnegut family, as well as something that we feel is important to do. So partnering with Indy 11 and getting that outreach really will help. And we'll kind of start with this new building to also bring those students in and have
great.
A place for them to connect.
Yeah. What about physical artifacts? I mean, you've got some great things like, you know, his typewriter, and of course, there's this great unopened letter that he had sent when he was in World War II that is on display or has been on display. Are there other like really interesting artifacts that Maybe you haven't had the space to show before that
you're
able to?
Yeah, we have quite a bit of his artwork that
and
we haven't been able to display.
He was a really prolific artist.
He was, and it's beautiful art. Mm-hmm. He worked with Joe Petro, who's an artist based out of Lexington, Kentucky. And so Joe is a big supporter of the Vonnegut Library and helped us gather some of this artwork to add to our collection.
Okay.
And then also we have a great collection called the Shear Collection from a gentleman based out of Missouri who donated his entire collection of first edition books, signed copies, and pretty much any article that Vonnegut was mentioned in. Pretty much throughout his life.
Yeah.
So it's really fun to go through that. And we'll be able to really bring that in and do some temporary exhibits of showing this collection as well as more of the artwork.
That's great. And, of course, something else that's going to help is the designation of the Year of Vonnegut. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so Mayor Joe Hogsett and Visit Indy and the Vonnegut Library has recently announced that 2016 or 2017 will be the Year of Vonnegut. The last Year of Vonnegut was in 2007 when Mayor Bart Peterson announced it, and that was also the death of Kurt Vonnegut in 2007.
Yeah.
So this will be the 10th anniversary of the Year of Vonnegut as well as the death of Kurt Vonnegut. And it's also, you know, our potential move-in date for the new building. So it felt the right thing to do. So we'll be doing monthly program with a lot of community partners. Indie Film Fest has come on, Theater on the Square. As I mentioned, Joe Hogsett in the mayor's office is very supportive of it. Visit Indy is very supportive of it. Lily is coming on. The IUPUI Arts and Humanities Institute will be partnering with us. I believe Indy Reads is partnering with us as well. So we're really excited about it. And it'll be monthly programming, bringing in some really heavy hitter authors as well as entertainers to really speak about Vonnegut, what he meant in Indianapolis, and what he meant in a humanistic side of, you know, being a good human and a good social citizen of the world.
So that's the time frame basically that you're looking at is raising the money by mid-July and then being able to open up the new library and museum in 2017?
We're looking to open it up around April of 2017. That'll give us enough time to do the build out, to make sure everything is looking how it needs to look, and then do a grand opening then.
Will there be any significant changes to the exterior of the building at all? Or?
No, the exterior, from my understanding, the exterior will stay the same. Most of the change will just be on the interior.
Okay, very cool. Hey, something else going on this fall coming up is going to be the Indianapolis Opera is doing a world premiere of opera based on Vonnegut's Happy Birthday, Wanda June. That's pretty cool, too.
Yeah.
Obviously, you guys are involved with that.
We are. We'll be doing doing a program with them, I believe, the night before it opens. A talk with Julia and some other Vonnegut scholars about the work and what it meant to Kurt Vonnegut. It's going to be really cool. I've heard some of the music, and it's just great. It'll be a great opera.
It sounds like such a fun, bizarre opera.
And the interesting thing, what they've told us, Indie Opera has told us, is that Kurt, who wrote the libretto before he passed away, actually changed the ending from the original play, because he changed it to what he had would have really preferred it to be. So
right, because it's an opera based on his play. A strange play, too. I mean, basically, a lot of characters, everybody ends up in heaven, and Wanda June is hanging out in heaven with everybody else.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
So that should be a lot of fun. So why, and obviously, I mean, Vonnegut's so important to Indianapolis, his family and the hardware store and the legacy, and even without Kurt, I mean, just so much influence on the city with great architecture. But of course, you know, Kurt Vonnegut, you know, turns into this world known author. And so, you know, that's important to Indianapolis. But why is Vonnegut still so important today as an author, not just as a historical figure?
You know, when people ask me that question, there's it kind of depends on who you ask at the Vonnegut Library. To me, it's because the way that he wrote really spoke to everyone. He was easy to read. You didn't have to, you know, set a dictionary beside you or remember your grammar classes from high school to really understand what he was saying. But also, the topics that he was discussing still ring true today, and it's still important. And so I think that's why generations still come back to Vonnegut. Every generation does, it seems like. One of our one of our coworkers says that probably says it better than anyone, I think. And he says that Vonnegut was able to take really difficult topics and present them in a comedic way that would mm-hmm. make people feel comfortable discussing it and reading it and still have that topic just as important yeah. as it was. So,
yeah,
it's wonderful now at our current location. You know, we have college students and even high school students that are taking just road trips during the summer, and they'll say, come in and say, you know, I came to Indianapolis because I had to make this pilgrimage. That's Vonnegut so cool. has spoke to me so much that I had to come and see this place. And, you know, it's kind of heartwarming to hear yeah. people say that and know that Vonnegut has brought so many people together.
So what's your favorite Vonnegut book?
You know, the first book I ever read of Vonnegut was Bluebeard, mm-hmm. and it's still my favorite mm-hmm. novel. It's not one of his more quirky novels, yeah. but I think it's just a great story, and it's an interesting look into an artist's life. Mm-hmm. The main character, Robert Karabekian, who shows up in a couple of other Vonnegut novels, you know, it just kind of follows his life, and it just kind of speaks to me, I guess.
You know, it's funny. Vonnegut's kind of one of those authors who a lot of people I talk to, it seems like whatever the first book that they read of his was, is their favorite.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, whether it was Bluebeard or Slaughterhouse-Five or what have you, that's, you know, I think it's that first experience of being introduced to his style and language and thought that really strikes people. And then they want to read more, but it's always like, oh, but the first one was the one that's closest to their heart, you know?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I would agree with that, yeah.
Great stuff. Matt, thanks so much for coming in Art of the Matter today. And
yeah, thank you for having
me. Best of luck with this campaign, because we all want to see the Vonnegut Library on Mass Ave.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with the Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library's Chief Operating Officer, Matthew Altizer. You can get more information at VonnegutLibrary.org. Again, VonnegutLibrary.org. Travis, you know what's coming up this weekend?
What would that be, Sharon?
It's my birthday weekend.
Oh, how lovely.
It's actually a couple days after the yeah. weekend, but therefore, I am proposing some things I'd like to do for my birthday on that calendar we call.
What do we do for Sharon's birthday?
For Sharon's birthday.
I know what you could do. You could come out to Wabash, Indiana, where they're having their big arts fest this weekend with different tours and events and lectures. And I'm even going to be interviewed as part of one of the programs by Renan Meyer from Time for Three on Sunday afternoon. And Kristen Chenoweth performing
yeah.
Sunday night. And,
at the Honeywell Center.
Yeah,
nice.
That's going to be a great weekend. Should be a lot of fun.
Are you going to play bass?
I'll let Renan take care of playing the bass. Yeah. Maybe he'll let me carry it.
There you go. Hey, on Saturday, July 2nd, part of that big holiday weekend, some of the city's best restaurants come together for a day-long festival on Monument Circle. It's called Taste of Indy, and you can have Asian, Greek, Cajun, Hispanic, Latino, good old all-American burgers and fries and that sort of thing, plus family-friendly events, and that's going on again this coming Saturday, July 2nd, from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. I'm sorry, that's next Saturday. I'm really hungry for my birthday weekend.
Sharon.
Sorry about that. That is next Saturday. Don't show up this Saturday, or you'll be sorely disappointed. Anyway, July 2nd, 11 a.m. to 9 p.m.
Very good.
I'm hungry. I can't help it.
I know. There's a lot of great stuff going on at the State Museum. Recently, you talked about the 200 Objects of Indiana. Also, there's the 200 Years of Indiana Art Exhibition. And something that Mark Rushman, the curator, is doing is a one-day event on Saturday, July 9th, from 10 to 5, and it's called 219 meets 317. Hmm. It's named for Indiana area codes, and it's going to take place along the canal outside the back door of the museum. And there's going to be a group of Latino graffiti artists from the region to compete with 317 graffiti artists, the Fab Crew, on a temporary wall. And there's going to be lots of other festivities, including a DJ and craft beer from different Zipgur area codes squaring off. And Big Car will be there bringing their Wagon of Wonders and a public mural art project. And lots of fun things going on throughout the entire day. Again, that's on Saturday, July 9th at the State Museum.
That sounds fantastic. You know, there are so many more things, but we're out of time already. And don't forget, you can learn about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide. The Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide. And we will tell you about 4th of July weekend events next
so
week on our calendar.
So much to do for the 4th of July. Yes,
that
on that calendar we call.
What'll we do? Red, white, and blue.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Billy Elliot loves to dance, but he's surrounded by people who think he should take up a more traditional form of exercise. Billy's journey makes for a poignant and joyful musical, and local nonprofit theater Bob Drex is taking us on that trip over the next 3 weekends. Sharon Gamble invited director and producer Bob Harbin in to talk about Billy Elliot.
So before I turned on the microphone, you were talking about the world Billy Elliot lives in. And it's the world of coal mining, and you were talking about having a conversation with your costumer.
I wanted to make sure that we understood that these clothes that we see the guys in wouldn't have the same level of clean that, you know, we're not talking bleach and additives and
no Tide extra.
No. And this is something that I think is so comparable to Indiana. We've had a lot of coal mining in this state.
My grandfather
was a coal miner. And bless him, died of black lung. So that many times the future of young people in families of coal miners, that's your future. It's already set out. It's almost like a prearranged marriage. You know, it's a prearranged future for you.
It's your family's profession.
Exactly. Like many times, the same way I think with farming and other occupations, it's something that you do for survival. It's something that you do to keep the family afloat. And you don't have time to sit back and think, gee, you know, I think I'd rather be a Renaissance painter, you know, than go back down into the mine.
And we're not talking about the 19th century.
No, this is quite recent. This is 1984.
Right.
When the coal miners went on strike in England, and Maggie Thatcher said, oh, no. So that you know, and strike and battle infused, and so it's the story of this young man, who you know, and you know, it's called Billy Elliot, and it's about him, and it's his rise, you know, above all these things. But it was a mentor. It was a woman who taught a class, who realized that there was something more going on with this young man, and it's through her that he was able to change his story.
And he's actually sent to take boxing lessons, right?
Yes, because that's
because he's getting picked on.
Toughen up.
He's a little bit smaller.
The only way to fight back is, you know, is to literally fight back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, you know, something that builds your muscles, builds your body, whatever, to be in the mine.
Right.
And you know, and he starts, of course, because of this woman, he starts using his 50 pence to pay for dance lessons instead of boxing lessons, and not tell Dad about it.
And his mother's gone.
His mother has passed. Yes, we have a character in the show called Dead Mom, it's so fascinating and for me rewarding to think that, you know, there are those people out there for us who are willing to listen to us, who are willing to pay attention and try to help us change a pattern, you know, change. And that's what happens here. You know, if it were not for this woman, you know, he'd be in a mine.
And
his brother is in the mines.
Right, and it's, what, give or take 30 years ago. Mm. And there were a lot of stereotypes about dance. And
oh,
who could
everyone,
dance, who
everyone who
dance.
Danced was a poof.
Yeah.
And to some degree, I suppose there's some truth in that.
Stereotypes sometimes come from places,
sometimes,
right?
Yes, they define. But
and the story of Billy Elliot does get into that territory. Right?
Sure, absolutely, because you know his best friend happens to be gay,
mm-hmm.
And it's and so there's a lot of information in this show that's so positive and so life supportive. It's how we deal, you know, with our neighbor, how we deal with people in our own family. How does his father have any idea what he wants to do or what's going on in his head? No.
His father doesn't have time to think about these things. And his father, in his own right, is probably adrift because he's lost his wife. He's lost the person who was going to raise his child.
I remember that, you know, I was born in 1951. Don't tell anybody.
Your secret's safe. Our listeners there you go. Don't. No, our no listeners one. Don't talk.
And my father came from the country. I mean, you know, my mother was the daughter of a coal miner, and my father's family was very poor as well. So when I was born, and you know, first born was a guy. That was that's great.
Yep.
You know, that's the old male, you know, standard. And yet when this firstborn son grew up, he liked watching movies. He liked embroidery. He, you know.
And how did your parents deal with that?
Well, and unfortunately, it was a lot of neglect. Not because they didn't love me, I learned later. Of course, at the time, I'm thinking, nobody loves
me. Nobody understands me.
Exactly. Go eat worms. But more than that, they simply didn't know what to do.
Sure.
So in a case like that, I'm busy. I've got to provide for my family. I haven't got time to try to figure. I mean, we didn't have in the 60s and 70s and 80s. We didn't have Dr. Phil. We didn't have Oprah. We didn't have people on TV telling us to listen to our children and try to understand each other. So it was far easier for him to just push me aside.
Mm-hmm. You seemed to be safe doing whatever it was you were doing over
exactly,
there.
Not causing, you know, yeah. a huge amount of trouble. And you know, you don't necessarily want to advertise, you know, that the boy can embroider pillowcases better than, you know, someone else's
than
wife.
His sister.
Or something. Yeah, and that's a lot of what's going on here is that it's not so much that there's not any love in this family. It's just there's no one to say, stop.
It's foreign.
Yeah, absolutely. So he, through the guidance of this incredible woman, his dad finally sees him do some dancing and is like, oh my, I couldn't do that. You know, this is, it's physical. It's amazing. And he's convinced that his son needs the chance. He needs the opportunity to do something different and takes him to London and he's approved, you know, for a dancing scholarship, and we can only imagine the good things
that
happen
in the next chapter. Yeah. So this started with it started as a book that was
yes.
made into a movie
in 2000. It was an English movie.
Right. Right. Has it been that long ago?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And then
in 2006,
as sometimes happens, it goes from film to stage.
It was developed into a musical. Sir Elton John has done the music. The wonderful Lee Hall did the book and the lyrics. And it's also a terrific show in that the songs are incorporated into the story. They're not
everybody pulled. Doesn't just suddenly stop and face the audience.
Exactly
and sing.
Right. and it, they're not written, even though Elton John, you know, did the music, they're not written to be pop sensational hits or anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's meant to service the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's incredible. It's kind of epic in its own way. And And it's so nice that they don't make any apologies. They just tell the story as realistically as they can. It's wonderful to watch it. You know, it already. It's impossible not to have an emotional reaction to, you know, a young man who keeps a letter from his mom that he's to open when he turns 18, telling him how much she will have missed. Yeah, there you go. missed being in his life. Hmm. So it's a special show, and you know, won lots of awards in London and New York, and there are reasons for that.
I remember running into you someplace out, probably at a theater a few months ago, and I said, what show are you doing this summer? And you said, Billy Elliot, if I can find a Billy Elliot.
Yes.
And you found one.
We found one.
And there's a great Q&A with him on your website.
His name is Thomas Whitcomb, and he's he lives in Danville, and he goes to school in Plainfield, and he is already at his young age a triple threat. The boy can dance, you know, exceptionally well. He sings, he acts, cute as a bug on a rug. And I think that the people of Indianapolis will be amazed. Sometimes we're a little slow to recognize the wonderful talent that we have living next door to us. Mm-hmm. And Thomas is certainly an example of that. And we have wonderful people from, you know, all the different theaters in town. Holly Stoltz. Mickey Mathiadakis, Bill Book, wonderful people that some people who are regulars in theater will recognize, and a lot of others that it'll be their first time.
And several young people as Billy's
very
classmates.
We have a ballet corps of eight ballerinas. They're just terrific, and they're so talented. I don't know if you're. We have in surplus of 40 dance studios in Indianapolis.
No kidding.
And unfortunately, when we were first looking, very few boys. And so I think some of that is maybe left over from what this story is about, that it's still not a masculine thing to go out and be a dancer.
Whereas any dancer will tell you it requires every bit as much
athleticism
any sport.
Some, you know, football teams are having ballet taught to their players just for coordination and muscle control. And shoot, who, you know, if you're a straight young kid and you're learning ballet, look, you're surrounded by
beautiful
women
ladies.
And no other boys. There's, you know, no other competition. Go for it, guys.
Tell us about your choreographer.
Kenny Shepherd is our choreographer. He is a genius, and I don't use that term lightly. He takes tap, ballet, jazz, all in one show. And when you have, you know, a situation like this, not everyone is a professional. Not everyone
is
at the same level. So you have people who have, you know, well, I move well. And I think I've had tap shoes on a couple times. From that level to someone who's maybe taken 5 or 6 years of tap.
So he has to craft
choreography
that makes everybody look
that
good.
Works for both. That's not boring to the person who's done it a lot and not too challenging for the person who's still learning a bit.
Wow.
And Kenny takes his job so seriously. He's done wonderful, wonderful work at Beef and Boards. As a choreographer, and he's also you know, head of their Christmas show every year, so he's truly a gem in the crown of Indianapolis entertainers. So I'm awfully proud of what he's done, and I think you'll be impressed.
Favorite scene?
Well, I'll tell you. If I can get through the story, it is a scene with his mom who has passed, and she talks about how she will miss certain things in his life. And he keeps this letter with him all the time. And his instructor has found it, and there's a lovely scene where the letter is read and Dead Mom makes an appearance. But I think what's special about it is when it's over, his instructor says, well, my goodness, she must have been an incredible woman. And Billy just says, no, she was just my mom.
Sharon Gamble with Bob Harbin. Bob directs producer and director. You can see Billy Elliot on June 24th and 25th, July 1st through the 3rd, and July 8th through the 10th at Marion University Theater. Get more information and read an interview with lead actor Thomas Whitcomb at bobdirects.com. That's BOBDIREX.com.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. when I'll find out how the Warehouse in Carmel brings top talent to a small venue.
I'll take a look at a new art exhibition at the Athenaeum that uncovers a mostly hidden chapter of German history.
And I'll chat with artist Nancy Maxwell. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.